right, for those of you listening online, this is Cameron, and this is class two of Culture After Christ, where we are going to look at the history of modern philosophy. Sadly, when we recorded the session on Sunday night, the computer had issues, and we did not get the audio file. So I am re-giving the lecture specifically for online. So if you're listening again and it sounds different, that's why, but it should be pretty similar. So Culture After Christ, we've been trying to look at potential answers to the question, how and why has Western culture changed over the last, say, 300 years? If 300 years, it was nearly impossible not to believe in God, you needed belief in God to sort of understand your place in the world and in society and the universe. You needed a belief in God to answer the fundamental questions of life, the big important ones that every worldview must supply an answer to. How did it happen that now, 300 years later, it's nearly impossible to believe in God? And in fact, the Christian answers to those questions are sometimes held in ridicule or with suspicion. So especially in these first 3 weeks, we're looking at some of those issues. Last week, we looked at a couple of things. We looked at the role that worldviews play in how people form their beliefs. What is a worldview? What goes into it? How do people choose their worldviews? And then we kind of did some worldview comparison. How does one critique a worldview from outside of it? And ultimately, what distinguishes the Christian worldview from one or two of the major competing ones that are out there? We talked a bit about Francis Schaeffer's idea of sort of the philosophy's influence on society. If you remember, we talked about his view that basically major cultural shifts, or some of them, happen through philosophers initially. The philosophers are up in the academy. They're the smart thinkers. They're the academics. They come up with some ideas. And really, generally, people don't read those ideas. They don't want to engage them. It's too boring. So the artists end up being the one. Usually this is kind of like fine art, high art, avant-garde. They're constantly looking for inspiration. And so they will read the philosophers. They're engaged in that kind of stuff. And they end up functioning almost as like the priests of the philosophy down to the general culture. So through the arts, these ideas gain traction in general culture. They get filtered into pop culture and pop music and movies and TV, and they get filtered down to even things like local politics and even city politics, because now that those ideas have disseminated into the general culture, people are now ready to enact them into law in some cases. Realms like that. And then interestingly, and we don't really have time to talk about it in the span of this class, but Schaeffer sees the fourth step as theology, the church. So when an idea gets trickled down, eventually, once it's reached enough mass appeal, the church kind of ends up being the last one to sort of form itself into the shape of the culture. And so we would view that as a bad thing in most cases, as a leaving the biblical worldview and biblical principles and jumping into a different idea. And so as a church, that should give us pause. Are there ways in which we as a community are allowing that process to take place in our church, where we're leaving the historic gospel, we're leaving the historic teachings of Jesus and his apostles and the biblical writers, and bending that into something else, something that's been shaped through this process? So that's a good question. So this week we're going to jump up to the top of that stair-steppy thing and look at the world of philosophy. I know that philosophy can be really, really boring. I know that it may not be the most engaging or exciting thing to talk about, but we have several good reasons for doing that, for spending the time, probably about an hour or so, to do this. So I first want to read a couple of passages from Scripture. We're not going to have time to fully exegete them, but let's have a quick engagement with them. So in Acts 17, this is classic text as it relates to Christians engaging culture around them. starting in verse 22, it says, "So Paul, standing in the midst of the Areopagus, said, 'Men of Athens, I perceive that in every way you are very religious. For as I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, I found also an altar with this inscription. It says, "To the unknown God. What therefore you worship is unknown, this I proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. And he, from the one man, every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth. He made from one man every nation to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place, that they should seek God and perhaps feel their way toward him and find him. Yet he's actually not far from each one of us, for, quote, in him we live and move and have our being, end quote. As even some of our own poets have said, quote, of your own poets have said, quote, for we are indeed his offspring, end quote. Being then God's offspring, we ought not to think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and imagination of man. The times of ignorance God overlooked, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent, because he's fixed a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by a man whom he has appointed. And of this he has given assurance to all by raising him from the dead." So you'll notice a couple interesting things here. As Paul is wanting to engage the men of Athens, he quotes their thinkers. He quotes their poets. He quotes, you know, perhaps the ideas of their philosophy. And he's willing to engage with and point out, look, there are areas in which, in ignorance, you have actually stumbled into the truth. You've proclaimed something that actually syncs up with what God has revealed to us. So he affirms that in them. You've discovered something true, but then he pushes it and uses that as a bridge to connect the good news of Jesus. So Paul is knowing, and he's engaged with kind of the intellectual life of those he's trying to reach, those he's trying to have a missionary impact on. And I think that's a really powerful model for us. He's both conversant with what they think and believe in their art and their culture and their life, but he's clearly not shaped by it. He's clearly not allowing that knowledge to diminish or to threaten his knowledge of and application of the gospel. So that's really huge. I also want to bring up real quick Jeremiah 2, verses 12 and 13. And that Jeremiah says this. He says, "Be appalled, O heavens, at this. Be shocked, be utterly desolate, declares the Lord, for my people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, and they've hewed out cisterns for themselves, broken cisterns that can hold no water." So Jeremiah is, he's pointing out something really powerful. Israel at the time, they had not only rejected God, the source of life, the source of living water, but they had actually tried to create alternate sources of living water. They hewed out cisterns. But he says these cisterns, they hold no water. And so I think that, in a nutshell, is in part the story of modern philosophy. It's the rejection of God as the foundational starting place, God's revelation as the thing that grounds and gives context for our use of reason and logic and our ability to do science and to understand morals and human dignity and all the answers to these big questions. It's setting God aside as the one who provides the foundation for all of that, and it's building a new one. I'm going to start with human reason alone. I don't need God at any point in this process. And so Western philosophy, I think, bears to the truth of this idea that maybe in beginning with that point and seeing the way that Western philosophy has sort of just been a game of diminishing returns, smaller and smaller goals, smaller and smaller ability to actually make sense of the world and provide meaningful answers, I I think that points to the reality that Jeremiah, that God speaking through Jeremiah was speaking to Israel, that when you reject God, the fountain of living waters, and try to create a new source, the results are disastrous. And so that's the point of what we're doing today. We want to sort of make the history of philosophy and even the word philosophy a little bit less threatening for us. We want to see how that history's played out so we can learn from it, so we can do several things. So I see philosophy as this. I really like John Frames, the Christian Reformed theologian philosopher. I like his definition of philosophy. It's the disciplined attempt to articulate and defend a worldview. So Christianity can rightly be called a religion, can rightly be called a relationship with God or with Jesus. It could be called a story, the grand biblical narrative, but it's also a worldview, as we talked about last week. And as a worldview, which by definition provides a comprehensive understanding of everything, it's distinct from and in competition with every other worldview that's out there. So we do distinctively Christian philosophy when we apply God's revelation and our worldview to big questions of life. So I don't think it's entirely appropriate to sharply distinguish philosophy and theology, as we kind of talked about last week. But why then should we study non-Christian philosophy? I see at least four reasons. Number one, to better understand and minister to our neighbors who don't believe what we do. Our non-Christian friends and loved ones, they probably have views influenced by secular, modern, postmodern philosophy. And so if we want to understand them, we need to understand the ideas that they've sort of picked up and are running with. Number two, we want to honestly face up to the biggest challenges facing our belief in Jesus. I mean, some of the most difficult, challenging challenges to our faith have come through philosophy. And so we don't want to bury our heads in the sand and ignore those. I think we want to be intellectually responsible to engage with the strongest arguments against what we believe. And that's not necessarily what we're going to be doing today. But hopefully today will be a foundation point, a starting point for us to go and do further study and kind of look at some of these things. Why else? Number three, I'd say to discover the genuine insights from non-Christian philosophy. There's one of the most beautiful Christian doctrines is the doctrine of common grace, that God in his grace has allowed even those who don't believe in him to make incredible discoveries, to taste his goodness, to operate in his good world, and to make use of it. And so through common grace, non-Christian philosophers have made incredible strides in knowledge. They've created incredible insight. They've made real contributions to the field of human knowledge, powerful ones. And so we want to genuinely glean from those and benefit from those, of course. And then a fourth, I think to gain confidence in our worldview. Competing worldviews often result in unlivable dead ends. And I think that's going to be part of what we're going to see as we study the whole shape of this history of philosophy. So we ultimately want to gain confidence in our worldview and make the competing philosophies and worldviews a little bit less threatening. So I hope at the end of this, that's what you'll feel, and that will have been done in part for us. So I have notes that cover some of the pre-modern philosophical eras. If you want those notes, feel free to email me, CameronHager@dorfhopepdx.org. We're not going to have time today to get into those. I think probably for our purposes, it's going to be important to just start with the medieval philosophy. We're not going to say much about it, but it does appear to be the case that in the medieval period, philosophy was dominated by Christian thought. And that's kind of along lines of what we've been saying. It was really hard to conceive of the world apart from the Christian story and the Christian worldview. And so from Augustine until the mid-17th century, Christianity was the strongest influence on philosophy in the West by and large. The maintenance of Western culture and civilization, it really fell to the church. And so some of what was going on, like there's Thomas Aquinas, one of the great, most influential philosophers of all time. And he synthesized Christian Roman Catholic theology with Aristotle's philosophy. And it's still influential today, what he did. he essentially said that the things in the realm of grace, which is like faith, revelation, scripture, salvation, sacred doctrine, that realm is one, and then there's the realm of nature, the realm of the natural reason, philosophy, the world, natural theology. He said, the first, the realm of grace, we need revelation from God for that. In the realm of nature, we can get by pretty well with what Aristotle developed for us. And so there's that. The Renaissance period following was not really much of a notable time in philosophy. It was in science. We had Copernicus, Galileo, these guys making incredible discoveries and pushing knowledge forward in that sphere. The world was being explored, Columbus, Magellan, these guys. But it was not a big time for philosophy. None of the Renaissance philosophers really had the kind of influence that the medieval ones did. And then there's the Protestant Reformation in there as well. The Protestant Reformation is something we're going to spend more time talking about next week, but the Reformers took knowledge and philosophy even in a radically different direction. They kind of wanted to dislodge it from the influence of Greek earlier philosophy, and they wanted to really have a return to biblical metaphysics, biblical epistemology, biblical ethics. Approaches to these subjects that hadn't really been thought of during the previous season, era. And so they were trying to make progress the biblical goal of taking every thought captive to obey Christ, which is from 2 Corinthians 10:5. So those are some of what was going on before we get to the modern era. And so the modern era of philosophy is where we're going to start. We're really going to start. The modern era begins basically with the Enlightenment period. And the key thinker here is the rationalist philosopher René Descartes. René Descartes was born in 1596, died in 1650. His major work probably is his Meditations on First Philosophy, published in 1641. So with this idea, he starts this project of rationalistic philosophy. His idea was to set aside every assumed traditional source of philosophy. He wants to get down to a bedrock, sure foundation that we're not just taking because it's been a trusted authority in the past. He wants to be absolutely sure that we're starting on a firm foundation. And so he has this desire to get every aspect of human learning into a single unified theory. For him, the roots were going to be metaphysics, the trunk was physics, the branches were ethics and the sciences. It was all going to be a unified theory that supported one. Each piece of it was dependent on, supportive of one another. So the question is, what is going to be that foundation that he's going to build this magnificent system upon? So he has a methodology. He says, I need to set out to doubt everything that's possible to doubt. Everything that could possibly be doubted, I'm going to doubt. So he starts to doubt things like, well, you know, I think that when I'm going about my day and experiencing things and seeing things through my senses, I think it's real. But, you know, of course, like, we've all had really convincing dreams, haven't we? We've all been in the middle of a dream that we were so convinced was real that it was a shock when we woke from it and into real life. So he says, it's possible that real life, quote unquote, real life as I experience it, is a deception of some kind. And so through processes like that, he's working down until he lands at what he thinks is the undoubtable bedrock. Cogito ergo sum. I think, therefore, I am. Surely we've all heard this phrase before. His foundation was the absolute certainty that though he might doubt everything in existence, he could not doubt that he was a thinker. Though he may be deceived on every other matter of life, I am thinking in this moment. I am at least a thinking thing. I think, therefore, I am. That's his foundation. And from that foundation, He wants to build back up to, he ends up believing in a trustworthy God, and then he thinks that this God is trustworthy, so therefore the world is not an illusion because God's not trying to trick and deceive him. So he then builds back up into a credible, comprehensible, external world that he can interact with. And ultimately, his philosophical system boils down to man is a thinking mind, that's one category, and then matter is extension in motion. So that's where he goes. And, you know, each of these philosophers, we're going to just talk about them, obviously, in just a quick, brief overview. We're going to try to give you just one or two of their core ideas. If you're interested in them, feel free to go and dig into them a bit further. I'm going to provide some good resources for that at the end. But I want to provide a takeaway sentence for each one of these. One idea that has really trickled its way down into the broader culture, because no one today is really a strictly rationalist in the sense of like following Descartes' system. No one's organizing their thoughts that way for the most part. But this idea for Descartes' rationalistic philosophy is in the air we breathe, and it's this: I am capable to decide truth for myself. It was Descartes that kicks off this project. I will be the arbiter of truth. I'm going to look inside myself. The undoubtable thing will be within me. It's not God's revelation. It's not anything in the external world. It is myself. And that is really a pretty amazing and scary project. So now we're going to move forward and see how that foundation led to everything it led to. So the next big school of philosophy that came after Descartes' rationalism was empiricism. So if rationalism begins with metaphysics, it begins with what is, it begins with I am a thinking thing, and that's its axiom, and it's going to build up from that, its whole system. A guy named John Locke comes along with empiricism. He critiques that. His major work was an essay concerning human understanding, published in 1689, several decades after Descartes' work. And Locke argues that we can't comment on the universe, we can't comment on the world, until we have a methodology for knowing the universe. So where Descartes started with metaphysics, Locke's going to start with epistemology. He wants to start with a theory of knowledge. He wants to figure out a methodology for how we go about gathering knowledge. And then we can build from there. So he rejects the idea of innate ideas, of knowledge that you can have before experience, of a priori knowledge. He wants to argue that the mind is a blank slate. It's a clean slate. It's a tabula rasa. And this blank tablet gets filled up with experiences. But he points out these experiences are not directly engaged with the substances out there in the world. You know, everything gets mediated through our senses. So that's in basic abstract terms, that's his idea. His takeaway, the takeaway that I would say that's trickled its way down, is seeing is believing. We begin with our senses. This is empiricism, and it's still ideas of it are super powerful today, super influential. But inherent in Locke's empiricism is a flaw, or at least a hint of skepticism. If we can't know the real substances out there in the world, but they all actually just are translations through our senses, do we really have confidence that we know the world out there? Or do we just know some version of it, some twisting of it, some translation of it? So that is where the next major thinker comes across, and that's David Hume. He saw the skeptical cracks in Locke's empiricism, Hobbes' empiricism, George Berkeley's empiricism, and he's going to force them apart. He's going to see those cracks, and he's going to split them apart dramatically into a more consistently empirical approach that devolves into a skepticism. So he's kind of an empiricist skeptic. Hume, he does this. He wants to say we have experiences, some of which are, there's two categories. There's impressions, so that's like your sense perceptions and immediately what you feel. And then there's ideas. And ideas are fainter copies of impressions. They're like memories. And then he wants to distinguish between the relations of ideas. That's something that's true because of the definitions of the word. For example, every unmarried man is a bachelor. We know that's true because of the definitions. Unmarried man, by definition, is the same thing as a bachelor. That's a certain kind of knowledge. But then he says there's relations of facts, and those require scientific sensory verification. The problem is that this second category, relations of fact, it can only supply probability, not certainty. His thinking ends up cutting the legs out from under God and miraculous, because how could you ever verify God with the senses? It undercuts ethics, because where can you verify moral obligations with the senses? We talked about that last week. And it even undercuts the idea of causation. How can you verify causation with the senses? You can have probability, but you can't have certainty. He even uses an example of a pool. It's like a pool ball. When you see one pool ball on the table slam into the other and send it flying, we assume that that's a cause and effect relationship. The first ball, the force of the first ball is transferred into the second ball. Cause effect. This is really what we observe, is one ball hitting the other, but there's no way to actually get behind those two things and know for certain that the first caused the second. Could be coincidental. There's a radical skepticism here that Hume is introducing. And so the takeaway for this, I would say, is, can we really be certain of anything? He's doubting that we can get certainty through the empiricist project, which in turn was a response to the rationalistic project. So Hume is kind of cutting the legs out from our modern philosophical project here. So everything seems lost. Where are we going? What are we doing? Can we actually know anything? Until the most influential philosopher of the last 200 plus years appears on the scene. Immanuel Kant. And his Critique of Pure Reason in 1781 is so influential. I've tried to read some of it. I have a copy. It's so difficult to read. It's so dense. And even as I read other philosophers in their historical works commenting on Kant, it's generally the consensus he was not a clear writer. He's not an easy read, but he's been so influential. So he saw the divide between rationalism and empiricism, and he wanted to find a way to synthesize them and save knowledge from Hume's skepticism. So he began his thinking in the rationalist tradition, but he was woken up from his, he says, his dogmatic slumber by studying Hume's empiricism. He wants to make philosophy truly scientific. And to do that, he thinks it needs its own Copernican revolution. You remember Copernicus, who argued against the idea of the Earth being the center around which the sun rotates, but instead, or revolves. Instead, he argues for heliocentrism. The sun is the center, and the Earth revolves around it. Kant saw himself as doing this kind of major reversal or shifting in the realm of philosophy. So his revolution calls for an end to the failing quest to discover reality through reason and sense experience, to conform our thinking to the world around us. And instead, he wants to argue that it is the human mind that imposes order on the world. No longer does the world impose order on us. We impose order on the world. This is radical, and it's really an amazing shift. And so Kant, his system, he divides the world into two realms. It's kind of like Plato, the philosopher, not the children's putty. Kant divides the world into two realms. The noumenal world, that's the world of things as they are, apart from our experience, the way they really are out there in themselves. That's one realm. And then there's the phenomenal world. the world of things as they appear to us, the world of experience. So he separates the world into two worlds, and then he says that genuine knowledge of the phenomenal world, it is possible. He assumes that. And then he works backwards to find out what conditions must make that knowledge possible. And then he assumes those conditions. This is what he calls his transcendental method. So he says, perceptions are meaningless in isolation. Concepts are meaningless in isolation. We have to get them together. And we do that through this transcendental method. But Kant's system, if you'll notice, it ultimately narrowed the scope of what was philosophically possible to discover. We can only meaningfully talk about the things in the phenomenal world. And really, the structure, it's knowledge of the structure of our own minds. So he ultimately is a bigger skeptic than Hume, because he says we can't know, have any knowledge of the way things are in and of themselves. We can only know things in the context of how our mind processes them. So has he saved philosophy? Has he saved science? Has he saved knowledge? It's kind of hard to say that he has. It's kind of hard to say that he has. He's ultimately a bigger skeptic than Hume himself, though he thought he was rescuing it from Hume's skepticism. So the takeaway idea from Kant's idealism. So remember, I should say this. You've got rationalism. We use reason. We've got empiricism. We use the senses. Now we have idealism. Our mind is the one that imposes order. Our mind imposes order on the world. Excuse me. And the takeaway is reality conforms to me. It puts man in the center and makes the universe, it makes ethics, it makes knowledge revolve around him. It conforms to us, not us to it. And that is a major, major shift. So following him, the next major philosopher is Hegel. George W.F. Hegel. His Science of Logic was published in 1816, just for a place of where we are in history now. So his German idealism, it was the result of taking Kant's philosophy. He removes the noumenal world from it. He says, we don't need this noumenal world of things in and of themselves. He gets more extreme. He says, all we have is the world of the human mind. All reality is mind. This is the pure formal idealism. His central quote is this. Listen to this. This is amazing. The real is the rational, and the rational is the real. So in some ways, it's kind of an extreme return to rationalism, but it's different. He means this differently. The mind is what's fundamental. The mind is what's fundamental in all of reality. The only thing that's real is what can take place in the mind. So his actual philosophical system is interesting. He thinks that we can build up rationalist philosophy through a dialectical process. And this has been a really influential idea. So how does it work? First, there's a thesis. Somebody has an idea. Pick an idea. Here's the idea. This is the thesis. Secondly, a contradiction, an antithesis arises. So now there's two ideas. There's the first idea and its opposite. It's antithesis. It's negation. And then what happens then is a synthesis takes place between those two. A third idea comes that is a merging of those two. It's the midpoint. It's the result of an idea and its opposite. There's a synthesis. It rejects whatever's false and it forms a new thesis with a better, broader perspective. And then we start the process over again. So this synthesis becomes our new thesis. Then there's a new antithesis. And then there's a new synthesis. So it's this descending triangles that happen. And his idea was that we'd get better and better knowledge until we get complete knowledge of the world. And Hegel actually thought he had kind of a supernatural, spiritual view of this. He thought history itself had a purpose that was being worked out by the absolute mind. It's world spirit. That's his concept of God as the ground of all being. So that's Hegel's system. I mean, in very broad strokes. The takeaway is that nobody ever has a monopoly on truth, right? I mean, if Hegel is right about this, then you've never really arrived. Like, take Christianity. You're making claims about the way God is, the way salvation works, the way history has played out. You've got particular ideas. You've got your theses. Well, there is an opposite out there that negates it. And the truth is some synthesis of the two. So this creates the idea that, listen, no one's ever got access to the whole truth. Interestingly, Hegel did think that his own idealism was kind of the high point, was the final synthesis and the ultimate idea, interestingly enough. He wasn't really open to some new idea in philosophy coming and critiquing his idea and forming a new synthesis. He thought, with his thinking, we have arrived, interestingly. Now, Francis Schaeffer, Christian theologian, apologist of the 60s, he was freaked out by Hegel. He was totally freaked out because he saw that with Hegel's system, there is now no longer, if this stuff gets mainstream, there's now no longer the possibility of true distinction. No one is able to look at another idea, system of philosophy, truth claim, and say that's wrong. If Hegel's correct, we're reduced to, like, no longer there being true antithesis. Like, you're saying one thing, I'm saying one thing, we can't both be right. Absolute knowledge, absolute truth gets tarnished. No one has a monopoly on truth. So Schaeffer saw this as, he calls it the line of despair. Once a culture crosses this line and embraces this philosophy, reason is now impossible. Because we can't make real truth claims, real meaningful distinctions. So I think that's a really important point to bring up. You can read more about this in Schaeffer's work, Escape from Reason, in a bit more detail, The God Who Is There. Very interesting. And then briefly, shooting off of Hegel's idealism is Karl Marx with communism, or some people call it dialectical materialism. His philosophy, he rejects the spiritual vibes of Hegel, and he's a strict materialist. He believes in nothing but matter in motion. But he agrees with Hegel that there's a conflict between, that there's conflict, a thesis, antithesis, and then synthesis, and that pushes history forward. But he's like, the mind is produced by material reality. Hegel thought the mind was the foundation of life, and everything built from that. Marx thinks material stuff, material reality is the foundation. Mind springs out of that. So he saw the shaping forces of the world as economic or class conflicts. His ethics kind of boils down to relativism. Whatever benefits one class is right. So two opposing classes can have opposite ethics. But here's a major contribution from Marx that we're still hanging on to today. He predicted through his dialectical process a future stateless utopia where everyone is going to work for the good of the collective society. John Frame calls this a secularized version of the new heavens and the new earth. Marx really thought that the historical process was pushing us to a utopia. The takeaway, we can achieve utopia by ourselves. We don't need Jesus for the kingdom. We can build it ourselves. We can build it ourselves. Now, he was writing this stuff in, you know, His Capital was published in several volumes in 1867 through 1883. The 20th century, in my view, has not borne out Marx's idea, nor the 21st. The 20th was the bloodiest century in recorded history, not in terms of percentages, but in terms of total number of people killed. Our ability for devastation in the 20th century is far greater than it's ever been in the past. Things like automatic weapons, nuclear warfare, we're able to be far more destructive, and we have been far more destructive in terms of sheer numbers. And the 21st century is on pace to outpace the 20th. So Marx thinks we're moving towards utopia. I think I would disagree. So then we get to the end of probably the modern era of philosophy. It's the end of the rationalistic project, the end of what Descartes started. and that's a philosopher named Friedrich Nietzsche. Perhaps his major work is Thus Spake Zarathustra, published in 1883-1891. Nietzsche was the philosopher who, at the time, most clearly understood and articulated the implications of his atheism. He saw both religion, and Christianity in particular, and Enlightenment philosophy as intellectual dead ends. He says, all claims about truth and morality are ultimately groundless, since first principles must be arbitrarily chosen and then acted upon. We talked about that a little bit last week. Your starting point for philosophy has to be assumed, it has to be taken on faith, it has to be presupposed. So given that, he says, look, since that's arbitrary, knowledge, morality, it's all groundless. Truth has to be chosen, not received. So he thinks there is no objective fact, only interpretation of fact. So for Nietzsche, to be human is to exercise one's will to power. That's what it comes down to. And there can be no outside force, especially a god, that's going to limit that will. Nietzsche declared, God is dead. With God, any meaning in life or absolute values. Nietzsche wasn't necessarily happy about the death of God. He thinks it's good that we as a people are recognizing this God stuff is silly, fairy tale kind of stuff, and we should reject it. But he realizes that it has a lot of big implications for life. And so his prescription then is will to power. Love the self. Advance yourself. Protect yourself. He calls this the transvaluation of all values. Values ultimately boil down to exercising your will to power. So the takeaway from Nietzsche, God is dead. Make your own life. So that's where we've ended. We start with the grand ambition of Descartes to have a unified theory of knowledge that's going to explain everything from a non-religious, non-traditional foundation. But through a series of critiques, we get to ultimately the meaninglessness of truth and the inability to really know anything objectively. So simply look out for yourself. That's Nietzsche. Do you see the way that the story has just narrowed and narrowed and narrowed, the diminishing returns? So if that is the story of modern Enlightenment philosophy, we now need to talk briefly about postmodern, late modern, some people call it metamodern, the most recent movements in philosophy. So we're going to quickly talk about a few. So Nietzsche ends the previous era and he kicks off the new one that's marked by really a lack of optimism in our ability to answer the big questions through philosophy. So what are we doing now in philosophy? What came after Nietzsche? Well, first, living around the same time, but writing a little bit later, there's William James with pragmatism. And he basically took the earlier utilitarianism of Jeremy Bentham, John Stuart Mill, the system that was concerned with ethics. How do we make the right decision about what to do? Well, you decide on an end goal, and then you make the choices that will most help you get to that goal. That's really crudely utilitarianism. He extends that. James extends that idea to a full system, a full theory of truth. His idea boiled down is that true ideas are those that work, that lead somewhere, that have cash value, that succeed. James said, truth happens to an idea. It becomes true. It's made true. And there's a good insight there. I mean, it is important to evaluate the practical consequences of truth claims, absolutely. But man, how could you turn that into a full system of understanding truth? And what's your definition of works, of what has value? So ultimately not a satisfying philosophy, but the takeaway is that truth is whatever works best, and I think we see that idea a lot in our culture. Another thing that came up was existentialism. And existentialism got mainstream really fast. It didn't take a long time to trickle down into culture because its key thinkers, at least in the most popular form, were Jean-Paul Sartre, a literary critic, Albert Camus, a journalist. They were able to take their philosophy and put it in novels and plays in these easily accessible, trendy, cool formats. And so their ideas really gained traction quickly. They're developing ideas that came from Soren Kierkegaard, the Christian philosopher in the 1800s, from Nietzsche, from Martin Heidegger, another existentialist philosopher. But their version became really popular. And Sartre, in particular, here's how it worked. He said, rejecting God, Sartre argued that man can have no basic essence. There's no infinite to tell us who we are. We have no basic essence. There's no essential human nature. Instead, we have only existence. Existentialism. That's where the name comes from. And that existence needs to be authentically expressed in the free choices we make. Our existence needs to be authentically expressed in the free choices we make. Does that sound familiar to anyone? You could almost think of Sartre's existentialism as Nietzsche's nihilism, but a little more happy, a little more optimistic. He doesn't view this as a bad thing. He says, look, now we get to choose for ourselves. We have the dignity of choice, and that will be what defines us, and it's really our only responsibility. So the takeaway of Sartre's existentialism, be true to yourself. Wow, has that been influential. Wow, is that an influential concept for us today. So it's not really a theory of truth necessarily. It's kind of a philosophy for life. He's ultimately as skeptical as the guys that have come before him, but there you go. Another big trend, perhaps the biggest trend in 20th century philosophy, is what's called the linguistic turn, a new emphasis on language. These thinkers were frustrated by the lack of consensus in philosophy, and they thought, maybe we can make more progress if we start shifting away from what is to what can be said. It's almost like, John Frame puts it this way, it's almost like converting Hegel's statement, the real is the rational, and the rational is the real, to this. The real is the sayable, and the sayable is the real. So the big guy who started this movement, really influential philosopher, Ludwig Wittgenstein, which is a really fun name to say, Ludwig Wittgenstein. His Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, also fun to say, was published in 1921. So he wants to establish limits on meaningful language, a perfect language. Language has to be made up of propositions which can either be true or false. If a statement can't be proven true or false, it's meaningless, and we need to not even consider it. But because everything can't be reduced to empirical facts, he creates a second category for statements, which he calls the mystical. And that can include religious statements, which belongs to the transcendent realm. So does that remind you of Kant's noumenal world at all? Yeah. There's this world that we can't really say anything about, but we might need to put some concepts in there that we use daily. You could even trace this back to Thomas Aquinas with his The Realm of Nature and The Realm of Grace. You could even trace this back further to Plato and his ideas, his realm of the forms up there. But this is Wittgenstein. His focus is language. He wants to clarify the language we use and things. Maybe this will help us solve some of these problems if we can just really shore up the way we speak about trying to answer them. So what's interesting, though, is he relegates language about the relationship between language and the world to the mystical realm. So what does that mean? At the end of his book, he ultimately acknowledges that his own philosophical work, the Tractatus, everything he said in it falls into the mystical realm. And there's like almost this interesting line he ends the Tractatus with. He says, whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must be silent. He took his own advice very seriously. He left the academy in 1920 to garden in a monastery. Then he went and taught in elementary schools, and then he went and designed a house for his sister. He just kind of realized almost the self-refuting nature of what he had written. and reduced him to silence. So he did those things for a while, but then he comes back onto the philosophical scene later with a pretty different take, and this is often called ordinary language philosophy, and it probably best summarized in his work, Philosophical Investigations, published in 1953. He argued that ordinary language, it's capable of fulfilling its functions. Words have many uses. Their meanings must be discovered as part of the tasks they perform in human activities. So he actually rejects now the idea of a perfect language. Language is therapeutic. It's to help people out of their language confusions. Perhaps one of the takeaways from this would be, don't assume you know what I mean. There's a complex network of interpretation that has to take place. Born out of early Wittgenstein's thought is a different idea called logical positivism. Logical positivism was kind of started by this group called the Vienna Circle. A couple of people were Moritz Schlick, Rudolf Carnap, A.J. Ayer. They loved Wittgenstein's work, but they rejected his world of the mystical. They thought that was silly. And so all they had left was scientism, basically. It's a philosophy composed of nothing except the propositions of natural science. There's four categories of language, and only one of them can convey factual information, and that's empirical propositions. So verification is a central idea. There's a verification principle stated that only propositions that can be verified by empirical science are meaningful. So for them, the question of God's existence wasn't true or false. It's more insultingly just nonsense. It's just nonsense. So for them, the problem was they could never really articulate the verification principle in a way that was satisfactory to their critics. They either destroyed the possibility of general scientific laws, or they made verification impossible because you can't prove a negative. So logical positivism was actually pretty quickly rejected, shown to be arbitrary, self-refuting, but man, does it still hold popular sway. Scientism is a very popular way of thinking today. Steven Pinker is a really good example. It's very interesting. You can go read his exchanges at the New Republic, the articles that were traded back and forth to get kind of a look at present-day scientism, which is kind of an expression of logical positivism. So the takeaway, science settles it. Scientific exploration is the only meaningful category of knowledge. Everything else is just pure nonsense. It makes sweeping claim that rejects anything that science cannot settle. I think you can sort of work out the worldview implications for something like that. And now we get to our last one. Thank you guys for being so patient if you made it to this point. We get to our last postmodern philosopher that perhaps the key, when you think of the word postmodern, this philosopher is probably the poster boy of it. Jacques Derrida. Born in 1930, died in 2004. His major work probably was Speech and Phenomena, published in 1967. And his idea is called deconstructionism. It's one of the key tenets of postmodernism. The central idea let's say this. The center of his philosophy is best captured with the statement, there's nothing outside of the text. Which he clarified later is, really there's nothing outside of context. What he means is that there's no reality that's not already interpreted through the mediating lens of language. Everything has to be interpreted to be experienced. And I think that's fair enough. I think that's a good insight in some, up to a point. It's a really good insight. But he pushes that too far. He pushes it into this idea that really, into this direction that really undermines truth as a whole. Other tenets of postmodernism are skepticism about meta-narratives, about all-encompassing views of the world, things like that. And so he plays into that. The way this really gets worked out most clearly is in literary criticism. His ideas led to this idea of meaning, the meaning of the text being found solely in the interpreter, in the reader. So before, traditionally, you read something and you're trying to understand what the author intended to communicate. You're trying to interpret it And the correct interpretation would be the one that synced up with what the author intended. Deconstructionism puts all of the power in the interpreter. That's where the meaning lies. What do you as the reader, as the interpreter, bring to it? What's your context? And then there's also kind of a looking at events, or in, as we're talking about literature, and trying to see the ideas that are behind it. What sort of assumptions, what sort of power plays, what kinds of goals and ambitions lie behind the text. So deconstructing it from that standpoint as well. So, you know, Anthony Kinney, the philosopher who writes brilliant historical accounts of the history of philosophy, he really has a harsh view of Derrida. He kind of views Derrida as not a serious philosopher. He hates the way that Derrida uses sex and shocking imagery to sort of maintain attention, views his writing as pretty sloppy and weak, and ultimately either his arguments are nonsensical because of his use of far too technical language and using words that mean one thing, but he uses them in a different sense, or his observations are so plainly obvious that why did he even need to take the time to say them? So that's kind of the hallmark of postmodern philosophy, and I think if I summed up the era completely, I would say the postmodern era is marked by a lack of optimism and a cynicism. Remember, the modern era, starting with Descartes, it was so optimistic. It was so excited about the potential of the human mind to discover and create unified theories of truth. But by the time we get to the postmodern era, those hopes are dashed. Those hopes are dashed, and people are merely trying to, or simply trying to solve these little problems. You know, pragmatism, whatever works, let's just do that. Deconstructionism, there's no real objective meaning, it's all in the interpreter. You know, Wittgenstein, language philosophy, they're focused almost exclusively on trying to clarify language. Existentialism is just happy nihilism, do what you want. There is now a cynicism about what we as people are able to discover on our own. And I think to wrap things up, I think that leaves us the story of modern philosophy's diminishing returns and kind of the downward sloping nature of it. I think it gives us an opportunity for the gospel. It gives us an opportunity for the gospel because, as we talked about last week, the Christian worldview, you know, it has such a power to provide satisfying answers, intellectually satisfying answers to these questions that, frankly, it feels like modern philosophy has just struck out on. The gospel, if we make the revelation of God our starting point rather than our own autonomous reason, we actually have the ability to use reason, to use logic, to do meaningful science. We know what man is, what woman is, what humanity is. We know what human dignity is and why it exists and how we're to treat people. We have legitimate absolute ethics, absolute morality. We have a universe that behaves in regular patterns that we can trust because God isn't a deceiving God. We have a goal for history. We have a mission in life. We have the promise of community extending into eternity future under the reign and rule of God, King Jesus sitting on the throne. We have the hope of an earth that's not going to burn up into cosmic nothingness, but of a recreated new heavens and new earth. It's glorious. It's perfect. That we get to participate in, and we get to continue to live in resurrected bodies with our friends and our families. We get to explore. We get to know one another deeper and deeper into eternity. Like, the Christian vision is so beautiful. And I think in a world that's increasingly moving away from the Christian vision, that's increasingly embracing the skepticism and the what appear to me to be the intellectual dead ends of so much of the philosophy that's out there, we have an opportunity to present something really powerful to people, to present hope, not just spiritual hope, although that's important, salvation hope, but but intellectual hope as well, that we can know things and that we can learn and that we were actually created to be able to make meaningful discoveries about this life that we live. So I think that's a really powerful piece. So I know this was a whirlwind. I hope it was bearable. I hope you found it helpful. I have some books I'd like to recommend for further study. The first two are just iTunes U classes. First is John Frame has a history of, the class is called History of Philosophy and Theology. It's on iTunes U from Reformed Seminary, and he works through this issue. You know, it's a full seminary class, say 25 lectures or something like that. Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. Similarly, Ronald Nash on iTunes U, he has a class called Modern Philosophy, which is doing the same thing, critiquing the history of modern philosophy from a Christian perspective. Nancy Piercy, she has a book called Saving Leonardo that is kind of an analysis of philosophy and art as it relates to culture, kind of covering the same period. It's very good. Anthony Kinney wrote... Let's look at two. First of all, he wrote what is considered the new standard on the history of philosophy as far as single author thing. It's called A New History of Western Philosophy. I haven't read all of it, but I've used it as a resource. Every bit I've read from it has been really well written, really engaging, really helpful. But then he has a short version that he condensed. So the big one's like 900 pages. Then he has like a 200 pager called A Brief History of Western Philosophy. Or A Brief Illustrated History of Western Philosophy. He has both versions. They're the same text. Really, really good, quick overview, really readable of all of this, starting with the ancient Greeks and moving up to present day. And then I would also mention my favorite thing I've ever read on this subject just came out last year. It's John Frame. He had decades of teaching the history of philosophy from a Christian perspective, and he finally put it down in a textbook form. It's called A History of Western Philosophy and Theology, and he talks about worldview, he talks about the history of philosophy, he presents it fairly, all the different philosophers fairly, but then he unabashedly critiques them from a Christian worldview, he helps us understand how to pull the helpful things from them, how to reject the things that are damaging and that conflict with the revelation of God. So that one is amazing. It's a really big book, but if you're interested in going deep or having a good resource on hand that you can consult with these philosophical issues, John Frame, A History of Western Philosophy and Theology. It's very, very good. So that's all I have. Next week, we're going to get into more movements in general culture. So we're going to look at some of the big historical eras. What happened at the Protestant Reformation? What happened in the 1960s in the U.S.? What is our current kind of cultural climate like? What are the big influencing factors? So it'll be another history lesson. I think it'll be a bit more engaging. And then in week four, we are going to move into pure application. So how do we, as a church, knowing how our culture has gotten where it has, how do we distinctively live as believers who are not separating, distancing ourselves from culture, who are not assimilating and conforming to culture, but who are cultivating it, who are a prophetic witness to the truth of God as we try to love our neighbors. So that's where we're going. Thanks for listening.